podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Happy Easter, everybody. I know it's a day late, but after some complications, I'm so happy to finally bring you this incredible episode. England have just returned from India after one of the most eagerly anticipated five test match series abroad for many years. One man who was right at the centre of it from an off-pit field perspective has decided to join me today. Peter Sim joined the England setup ahead of the 2022 Pakistan Test Series and has been there for all of the major success which England Test cricket has enjoyed since. This was an absolute pleasure to record and an incredible insight into the way baseball really takes place from a players and coach's perspective. I learned so much, and I think this really took away from some of the stuff the press have been saying. I don't want to waffle on any longer, so I hope you enjoy. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Good morning to you. I think the best place for us to probably start is for you just to give us a little bit of background about yourself. I mean, I'm obviously know exactly what you've done and that's why you're here, but a lot of people probably won't know that much about the England backroom staff, and I think you play a very important role. So if you'd like to just sort of kick off with that.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on as well. I appreciate it. Do you want me to talk as in like my hitism from where I started and then come through, or do you want me to talk specifically about like my role within the team?
Let's start in the present. What are you doing at the moment?
Cool. So my current role is physical preparation coach for England men's cricket, and I work specifically with the test team, or they do a couple of bits with, you know, white ball players when need going back in the country, but primarily with the test team. And it says physical preparation, but that's, it is a strength and conditioning role, but because we're trying to encompass, because a few more things come into that bracket, like nutrition and recovery and whatnot, we kind of reframe the title, which is kind of where it's going, really. A lot of the Australia have, they call them physical performance coaches, and America have their own sort of brand. So it's kind of moving, because it's trying to encompass, well, the role now encompasses more things than just S&C, like it kind of used to. So that's what I'm doing now. And then and the role is basically working with the players when we're at home, getting out on the road, seeing them, at times focusing on the lads that have got long-term rehabs or need more support that way. And then other than that, it's then getting out on tour with the boys. So just got back from India, which was a good trip.
Yeah, and that was, we'll start there. That was one of my main questions. Obviously, the England boys, especially the test side, probably only come together three times a year, and otherwise they're away with their counties. Does your role mean that you work with alongside the counties as well, or is it simply as soon as they come together, obviously away on tour, you're with them the whole time, but across England, someone when they're all moving around? Yeah, so do you work with the counties as well, or is it more you wait for them to join up with the
England? Yeah, 100%. And with it depends on the player's situation a lot of time. So, because some of the players, if they live nearby, you know, the county facilities, then they'll train there quite a lot with the county practitioners, and or they might have, you know, existing good relationships with them, and, you know, and they're quite self-sufficient with working with them, and that's great. And we've got a good network of county practitioners that kind of help us co-manage their players and our players. And then you've got others that live much further away. For example, like a Joe Root lives in Sheffield, which is, you know, an hour away from Headingley, so it's not easy for him just to drop in for a gym session every, you know, three, four times a week in at Headingley. But he has a setup at home, so I'll go and work with him at his house or somewhere local, as opposed to him dragging himself up to Headingley all the time. Whereas someone like a Harry Brook lives relatively local, he'll drop into Headingley and kind of a lot often slot into their program. So it just depends really situationally, really, and then also with that, you get it with the guys that have been central contract for a long time, tend to lean more towards the ECB staff or we kind of take more of a lead on them. And the guys that have either dipping in and out or are new to the England setup that have already got existing sort of relationships at their counties, I'm more than happy for them to take the lead on them, because at the end of the day, the county practitioners know more about that player than I do. And most of the time would have a better relationship than I do because I've not barely spent any time with them. So it's just until you kind of build up whoever is going to get the best out of them, really. And that's not a reflection on the quality of the practitioner. It's just relationship between the player and their situation.
You used two Yorkshire lads there. Obviously, before you went to England, you were involved with Yorkshire. Do you find that just because of your history with the players, you have a particular special relationship and sort of know the needs of those players more than the rest of the squad?
Yeah, I mean, it helps. I mean, yeah, certainly with Yorkshire, more that I've just known them a lot longer. And then and kind of, obviously, Yorkshire's a unique county and a lot of its traditions and whatnot. So it's kind of also understanding the background of that and then how they've kind of got to where they've got to. So yeah, certainly early on. I mean, I've been involved in England. We're working for ECB for like, what is it, 2.5, nearly 3 years as a consultant for the first half, and then more recently full time. But so early on in that, I definitely leaned towards. Oh, it was a lot easier to work with the Yorkshire players because it was just no different to what I've been doing with them at their counties when they were at the county. But now I'm more established within the setup. It's evened right out a bit, really. Got just as good a relationship with them as I do with the other players. So,
does your role differ from player to player? Like, do you have certain things which you'll do with one player and then someone else you'll be doing something completely different? So, say, obviously, the big news of the last tour is Jimmy's still going. He's 41. Is it the case that you leave him to do what he wants to? He knows his body. He knows how to look after it, and you sort of let him do his own thing? Or is it actually because he's getting that age, you spend more time with him to try and keep him fit and healthy?
Yeah, you certainly have priority players, and generally it's the fast bowlers because they've got the biggest physical demand, therefore they need the most attention when it comes to physical prep. We have our whole culture is around players driving their own programs, so it's moving away from the field's got so much better with it now, but the kind of stereotypical sort of drill sergeant S&C is in, I'm telling you what you're doing and this is what's best for you, so just do it. It's more, what do you think, where do you want to take your program, or what are your goals, and then nudging them in that direction. Right, well, I think this is what's going to help you with that. And then if they choose to, like, if they say to me, no, I'm not doing that, it's like, I'm not going to argue with them. I'll say, right, okay, let me reframe it, and I'll try, you know, push them down a different path, but it's their career at the end of the day. But you rarely ever get that, really. It's more just, there's loads of ways of skinning a cat. So, okay, you don't like that. You don't particularly like that sort of way of training. We can get the same outcome doing a different, going down a different avenue. I'm not bothered which way you do it. You do whichever one you like, because then it becomes, there's much better buy-in because they're like, this is the way I like to train. So they're driving that, not me. I'm not telling them how they should train. In essence, you have a little bit, but it allows them to kind of really take ownership of what they're doing. And as you know, if you're it's your decision to do anything, you do it with way more intent than if someone's telling you to do something you don't really want to do. So that's the culture we're trying to drive. So players like Jimmy, been training a certain way. Phil Scott, who preceded me, done some, you know, really close with Jimmy, and they've set up, found really good methods for him. And I'll be honest, we just kind of, now we're just rolling out the same stuff he's been doing for the last few years, but he's probably doing it more diligently now, and that's nothing to do with me. That's just him getting his head down, really. But again, it's him driving it. Sometimes he'll need me to drag him in there because I'm like, no, come on, you said that you like to do, you want to do this, yeah. So come on, let's go. But he'll blame me for being in there, but he does actually want to be in the gym at times.
I mean, you're probably closer to that than anyone, in a sense that, hypothetically, how, for a 41-year-old, how much longer is he realistically going to be able to keep doing what he's doing? Isn't it at some point his body's got to probably catch up with him?
Oh, you say that, but he's no different now than he was 5 years ago, I don't think, in my opinion. So there's no reason why he can't just keep going. He's, from the conversations I've had with him, he's still got the desire to keep going as long as he can. So I don't think he has any intention anytime soon. He may say that I'd retire tomorrow or something, I don't know. But from my understanding and everything, the impression I get with him, he's loving it. And if there's nothing physiologically stopping him, why can't he just keep going? Yeah, until it gets to the point where there's deterioration, then keep going, yeah.
That's good. Obviously, you were part of the Ashes series last summer, and one of the big things about that was Moeen coming back into the fold from, I mean, from nowhere. No one really saw it coming. As a physio's point of view, for someone who hadn't played much Red Bull cricket, let alone 5 days in a five-match series, what was your sort of thought process towards getting him? Because he obviously struggled with his finger, but match fitness on the whole surely wouldn't have been there. So from a physio's point of view, what was your sort of thoughts towards it?
I mean, Mo's a tricky one because very much does what Mo wants to do. And he's very content with the repercussions of that for himself, as in for himself. But his actual role didn't require him to bowl, especially in this country, quite as much as the workload. It's not like he was going to India and he was going to have to bowl, 40 sets a day in 35 degree heat. So he coped with it actually all right, other than his finger just flaring up a little bit. He didn't really have many issues, and we kind of knew that was going in because we knew what his role would be in the team. So he'd been playing loads of cricket, albeit white ball cricket, but he was more than prepared to play as to bowl when he bat like, well, I don't know, he ended up batting three, but bat six or seven or whatever it was, and bowl 15, 20 overs and innings is more than capable of doing that with the kind of current level of fitness they had. We didn't have to really change a huge amount. Don't get me wrong, optimally, you would want to increase his loads up there. But I don't think it would have made huge difference as a as an off spinner in the role that he had in that series. As I say, if that was India, that'd be a different story, I think.
Yeah, completely. And I guess the one injury that he did have was sort of unavoidable, not really anything that a preparation coach like yourself can do anything about. That was just simply.
Well, yeah, I like to say ideally, but it would have bowled a bit more in preparation for that, and then kind of the skin on his fingers would have got used to it. He had kind of got a bit tougher around volume of overs, but yeah, it is what it is. But then at the same time, that happened. Shoaib Bashir, we had a split finger in any bowls more than anyone, bowls 1,000 bowls a week, I think. So it just happens. That's just a common thing for spinners.
With the recent tour to India, obviously the two young spinners in particular, or three young spinners with Rahane as well. How much, as in, because Shoaib's exposure to professional cricket is so minimal. How much? What did you do a little bit more focusing on him and helping him sort of catch up? And did you find that he was a little bit more strained than others, or was it that he slotted straight in and was a bit of a natural to it?
So he, yeah, in one sense, yeah, he started straight in, is very, very natural to it, not just physically, but personality wise. He's real chilled, laid back, and loves the competition, and he's a really funny bloke. So, the boys got on really, really well, and I think he helped him settle into the environment really quickly. He's like, as you would expect, he's as green as grass when it comes to professional cricket, and it's quite nice to see because he hasn't come up. He has had involvements at Surrey and whatnot in pathway, but not like the traditional where he was nailed on to be a pro from the age of 15, which you often get at the England players. They've been in a setup and they've had loads of support, and they understand in a good way. They understand all the processes around professional cricket. Whereas Shoaib's obviously been a late developer in that sense and had some late success, so he's very much. Some of the conversations with him was what how you can't stand the conversations you'd have from a physical, not professional sort of point of view, is what you'd have with like an amateur cricketer. And it's all like brand new to him, and but he loves it and he's dead excited by it. And he's like, you introduce an exercise to him and he's like, wow, how good is that? You know what I mean? And it's just like, so it's quite cool and fun to I love working with him. And he's learning loads really quickly. And I think he'll go from strength to strength in that sense. As long as he can tolerate the demands of the massive increase in load he's going to have, and we've done as much as we can to try it so far to mitigate some of the risks that you get with big increases in load and intensity for him. But that's going to be a big challenge for him to keep kind of coping with that. But so far he's coped really, really well. But time will tell. All he can do is keep doing the things he's doing, really. So it's but he's really impressive and has a great attitude to it, is it? As does Tommy Hartley, with similar position, has played a bit more cricket than Shoaib, but not loads, especially red ball cricket. But again, very, very diligent, very independent with how he trains. He trains a bit like a 15-year pro. He's brilliant. He's had a more like sort of traditional sort of pathway kind of come up, and you can tell he's been around professional cricket for a while.
And obviously the focus is already turning towards someone. There's been a lot of talk about how at Lancashire, Tom's not even going to be the first choice spinner, most likely with Nathan Lyon coming over. And when Leachie's back fit, Shoaib probably won't get as much game time, although Taunton traditionally does turn more than most other places. Is there a worry that the two people who are probably going to be vying for that first choice England spot might be under cricketed and then under physically underprepared for Test match cricket again in the summer?
It's a good question. I wouldn't say, I don't have a great concern about them being physically underprepared, because they can still train both cricket and S&C, and chances are that you might find them, that I know there's talk of them going out on loan and whatnot, getting some competitive cricket elsewhere, but there's obviously still second team cricket. I know the intensity is nowhere near, but they can still play cricket and get a decent amount of volume in there. And the beauty of second team cricket is it's a little bit easier to manipulate, that if they want to bowl a 20 over spell, then
they can, yeah.
Because that's the games dictate that. So it would be a little bit easier. As a fast bowler, I might be a bit more concerned. But again, not in this isn't saying that spinners at a risk of injury. They are, as we've seen with Jack Leach, but the risk is not as high as it is, and not as common as you see in fast bowlers. So yeah, it's a bit of a concern, but not, I'm not losing sleep over it.
There's obviously a big Jimmy taken out the side. There's been a big issue with English fast bowlers and injuries. I mean, if you look at the current crop of who are on that tour, obviously Gus Axton didn't play, but Ollie Robinson, who only played one test, has had a whole host of injuries in what's been a relatively short England career today. And then Mark Wood, who is in probably the best bit of his career in terms of injury. Is there a bit of a consensus that English fast bowlers are just getting too injured and aren't necessarily putting the work in, or is it just bad luck after bad luck in terms of England seamers?
Oh, no, then certainly it's nothing to reflect. It's not a reflection of the work they're putting in. I think, well, one, fast bowlers get injured, regardless of that's cricket. It's a tough job. It's a bit like your super high-strung racehorses, more increase of injury. They have a higher increase of injury, like a Mark Wood, because of the speeds and forces that are involved with him to bowl how he does. And then other things that feed into it are kind of volume of chronic load. So what you often see is players till they're 26, 27 have on-off careers in terms of injury. And then when they get from 27 onwards, they then become a lot more robust because they've got, their body's got heart to bowl. And Pat Cummins is a great example of that. Chronic injuries all the way up until he was like 26, 27. And now is the most robust fast bowler you see. But everyone seems to have forgotten about his previous injury history that when they use him as this as the model student, I suppose. So there's loads of things that come into it. I wish I had the answers to why they get injured, because I'd be a very wealthy man if I could, because I'd be sort of a bit more sought after than I am. But it's certainly not a reflection of their work ethic. It's just there's. For each fast bowler, there'll be multiple different reasons as to why they may get injured. Luck coming into it, but you try to stay away from that as much as you can, because you're trying to look at what you can do to help minimise the risk. I never say prevent injuries, but we can minimise the risk as much as possible by putting various things in place.
So someone like Ollie Robinson, who in the nicest way possible, he's not Mark Wood. He's bowling low 80s, sometimes even late 70s. What's sort of causing his injuries? Because it's not necessarily as much stress. Is it, what would be the main factor in causing him to struggle so much recently?
It's a tricky one. I think Ollie's been on a good journey over the last kind of probably 4 years, where he had some, probably as has been documented, but some unprofessional behaviours, didn't really buy into his physical prep as much as he probably could have done. He's now turned a really good corner with his physical preparation, and he's enjoying it, and he's understanding the links that it has to performance. And then it's just now getting him to to work with intensity within training and in games and just get his body hardened to that. I think I genuinely believe if he gets a bit of a run of games together, bowling at good intensity, that'll harden him up, and then it'll be almost like a light bulb for him, and then he'll kick on and fly from there. Because whatever we've seen in patches, once he gets, you know, a game 200 belt, he then starts to really rev up. So hopefully this period of county games coming up will give him that kind of get the ball rolling into the summer.
How hard is it for someone like him, like Vasco, like he did in the fourth test, to come in having carried the drinks or tour, played very little cricket, because obviously there's no warm-up games anymore in a professional tour, to come in and be required to do what he, I mean, he didn't even bowl in second, he's come in and be that seam bowler in a way tour?
Yeah, I think it must be, I don't know, this from just being around him, you know, I don't mind to talk about what it must be like to play to bowl for England, I don't know. But from what you observe, you get some, it depends on the character. Like some people, that's like a big shock to the system in terms of mentally as well. And oh, I've got to rev myself up for a test match now after running drinks. Or you get some that are like itching to get on the field, you know, that in their that's what's motivating them, is to go from, they've been ready to go from ball one for months, kind of thing. And I don't think either way is a reflection of them as a person. It's just kind of how, what motivates or what gets them going. Some people need a bit more of that build in, and some people can just go from ball one. So I think he's one that certainly needs a bit more time, I think, as opposed to kind of, and it's like with everything with Ollie, he'll train really well, but it's one of them, you kind of have to get it on his radar.
Yeah.
As opposed to, right, we're going on really hard running session now. He'll be like, and I don't know about that. But then if you say, tell him an hour before, you've got a decent running session to do at the end. He's like, yeah, sweet. You know, so it's just, some people just have to process things a bit, get their head around what they've got, the task they've got in front of them. So.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you were originally a consultant, but you joined the England team at the back end just ahead of the Pakistan tour. So you sort of came into just after the first summer of Brendan's tenure.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the thing is let the players take ownership, and it's the whole thing that Ben and Brendan are trying to get into the squad. Is it a noticeable difference from, I know you only really worked with the Lions and were a consultant, is there a noticeable difference in the squad since that Brendan's taken over?
Oh, yeah. I mean, because that Lions tour in Australia, my first kind of involvement with England, we were training alongside the senior team. And I was on, obviously, because I was apparently the Lions, you're on the periphery of it. To be honest, it was all brand new to me. So I was like, I don't know. Is this what international cricket is normally like? I don't know. Because that's just my new experience of it. It's hard to, yeah, it is very different, but it's also hard to say. I would have liked to have seen that England team where they were within, you know, maybe the previous 3 years when things were going well, you know, because my own experience of it was when they were away in Australia getting pumped and everyone was in a really bad mood. And it was like, yeah, and it was COVID. We'd been in quarantine for 2 weeks before we came. So I think it's unfair to come, you know, oh, it's so much better now, Baz and Stokes. And don't get me wrong, it's brilliant. Like, I love it. And the boys love it, but it wouldn't be fair for me to like have a direct comparison. They're certainly different from like being on like calls, like planning calls for that Australia tour, and then compared to what you see now, it's certainly different. Kind of the language that's used is really different. But the language that was used, the previous one would be more like what you'd expect around like cricket for a sport at that level. It was very detailed and lots of planning and whatnot, whereas it's a little bit looser in this environment, but it's not a bad thing.
You say you love it and the boys are loving it. What is it specifically that you're all loving?
Oh, we just have loads of fun. Like it's really relaxed. In such a high pressure environment, or it could be such a high pressure environment, it feels like, I've described it to people before, it feels a bit like county cricket at times, in a good way. Because it's like, oh, it's just another game of cricket. You know, because I'm, again, this is what I'm, this is pretty much all I've known of international cricket, but it doesn't feel at times that much different from being around your county setups when there's, I don't know, on a Champo game, there's 100 people watching. It's just, you kind of forget it's a test match, which is good because I think the lads do as well, because there's already so much pressure. The last thing they need to think as they're walking out is like, oh my God, like this is big, I better need to switch on it. It's more the environment's almost trying to take some of that away, or it is trying to take that away and just make them concentrate and just enjoying where they are and going out and playing cricket with their mates. And people take that in the wrong way. They make it out like it trivializes test cricket and international cricket. It doesn't, because you don't need to be told how much it means and how important it is to realize it. Like, they obviously realize that what people trip up is that it's that becomes too much for them and then they can't cope with it. So if you can take some of that away, then as you've seen, they play with a lot more freedom and actually look like they're enjoying themselves. But
obviously that doesn't always come off, India being the prime example. What was the sort of mood within the camp at the end? Like, this is the first series where England under these two had been properly beaten, as in we got ourselves in decent positions but never converted. Was it, I mean, I hope there's a big sense of disappointment, but was it the fact that they're sort of just going to brush it off and look forward and not let it bother them too much?
Yeah, like, again, I don't want to speak for the players because it's, they're the ones that are out there doing it. But the sense I got and, from being around it is, yeah, obviously they're disappointed. Like, they want to win every game they play, and of course they do. So they're some of the most competitive people I've ever met. They never not want to win, but it comes back to, what does sitting there in a quiet room sulking, what does that actually achieve? It doesn't make you mean that you care more or that it's more important to you. It's more, well, let's try and get ourselves in a better mood because that'll put us in a better position to win the next game. Because why wouldn't it? Like, no one wins, no one performs well when they're in a sulky bad mood. So the quicker you can get everyone out of that, or the quicker everyone can move on to the next one, the better. And that's not ignoring the things. Obviously, again, this is the thing, is that obviously the lads will go back and reflect on how they can correct whatever mistake they thought they made. Or maybe it wasn't a mistake. It was just, no, I still made the right decision. I just executed it poorly. Doesn't make it a wrong decision. But obviously they're going to do that. You don't need to be telling everyone in the media that they don't need to tell people in the media, oh yeah, I'm going to go and study all the footage for hours and hours, because they probably do that anyway. It's just taking some of the pressure away, and that's what Baz's and Stokes' message, and they'll be almost, don't worry about it, because they know that might stop them worrying a little bit less than what they were already worrying. It doesn't mean they just stop worrying about it. So I think that's the misconception, really, is that they don't care about winning and they're not bothered. And as soon as the game finishes, it's like, oh, well, that was fun, let's move on. It's not that at all. But it's, if you can take a little bit of element of that, it helps prepare them for the next one. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Obviously, when Jack left after the first test and Rahane left after the third, I believe, was there a reason that England didn't call anyone else up? It seemed, from a fan's point of view, it seemed pretty strange that we then were, if any other injury or illness cropped up, we'd only have be left with one frontline spinner. I mean, as much as enjoyment was seeing Colley and Trez running in whites, it didn't necessarily paint the best picture.
I think it was just it was mainly because we had no injury concerns. Well, again, I wasn't part of that.
Of course,
there wasn't any chat. Yeah, and there wasn't any chat of it, if I'm honest. Reading between the lines, there was no injury concerns. They were quite clear on the team they were going to play in, or not the team, the squad that they were going to play in Dharamshala, and they expected it to. They were going up there thinking it might seem more that it would be a more seam wick. It turns out it wasn't what they kind of quite expected up there.
Yeah.
But so I just think they thought there's no point dragging someone all the way out here when they're probably, the likelihood is a very small chance that they're going to even be required to do anything. So yeah, it wasn't, no one talked about it. So as far as I'm aware.
that's fine. Well, we'll move a little bit away from England and talk focus more on you now. So obviously you're working cricket now, but looking back through your career, you started in, I mean, I think it was netball while you were at still at university and then rugby. Talk us through a little bit about sort of why you wanted to get into what you're doing and the path you've been on, really.
So I went to I did PE at Leeds Beckett for my undergraduate degree, and with a view of being wanting to be a PE teacher when I left school, when I kind of started there, did a week's kind of placement we had to do as one of our 2 week placement as one of our modules. I went back to my old school, and looking at PE from the other side is not as fun because you forget that everyone doesn't like it as much as you do. Whereas when you're a student, you just kind of surround yourself with the lads and the girls that like playing PE, like doing PE, and then. So I did that. I didn't have a good experience. I was like, you know what? I don't want to be a PE teacher, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then I was playing hockey for the uni. And with that, we got S&C. I didn't know anything about S&C, but we had a guy called Ian Fisher who was the eventually my boss at Yorkshire, was our S&C coach, and I just loved training with him, and kind of got introed through that. And then half through my second year, I kind of just decided, oh, this could be something I want to go through my third year, sorry, this is what something I want to go down, a path I want to go down. So I shadowed him for a bit, just with some of the teams he was working with. And then the following year, so after I graduated, did a full year's internship at the uni under a guy called Brendan Chaplin, who was the head of S&C at Leeds Met at the time. So I did a year with him, working with netball, MCCU cricket, the Leeds Met cricket team, which, funny enough, now was like the first team I ever had a lead on was a cricket team, was a Leeds at the time. You know, now I'm working in cricket. That's not what's led me to where I'm working now, because at the time it was just I'll just work with any team. And then the following year, applied for an internship at Newcastle Falcons Rugby Club. So just moved up to Newcastle. Voluntary position, so was working in a restaurant on a Friday night, and then a double on a Saturday and double on a Sunday, and then worked at the rugby club Monday to Friday, and then managed to pick up some paid work with Northumbria Netball, the Super League team, Team Northumbria. They worked with them on a Tuesday night, went Thursday night, and then a Saturday morning. So it was a pretty busy year in my life, that one. But at the same time, it was. I was doing pretty much all most of my work voluntary, but then I was like, imagine being paid for this. How good would that be? Because I was loving it, even though I was doing it for free. So, the following year after that, I did that for another year, and then they created like another academy role, S&C role, which they thankfully offered me for £12,000 a year. Yeah, was my first contract. So I did that, and then kind of did 5 years at Northumbria, not at Northumbria, at Newcastle. And then Ian Fisher, who was my S&C coach at Leeds Met, they had the assistant role at Yorkshire came up. So he said, do you fancy applying for this? He didn't offer me it there and then I had to interview. And then got that and then moved on and then been in cricket ever since, really.
Awesome. Well, that's great. A bit of background. I was just sort of interested. One final question would be that obviously it's three different sports. How much does your sort of the physio and the prep differ between each sport, or are there lots of things which cross over?
Yeah, it does differ. Obviously, you've just got to assess the demands of the sport and then choose your training modalities that kind of that train those demands. I think at the end of the day, you're still working with humans, so they still function in the same way. So whether a sport has like a really high aerobic demand and not a huge strength demand, you still know loads about, well, I still have a good understanding of aerobic development because I have to do it for cricket. I just weight more of my training in that sense to in that sort of direction. Whereas in a more of a strength power sport like a rugby, and then where they have to put gain some mass, we still have to have certain cricketers that we have to put muscle mass on. I just don't do a lot of my programming that because we don't want to try and put a lot of mass on. Whereas working rugby, I might tailor my programs to increase muscle mass more. So. And then with the actual specifics of the program, you probably have a lot of the time maybe 75% of a program across sports might look the same. It's the 25% which makes it specific to that sport. And then sometimes it might just be like the rep schemes that make it specific to that sport or the speeds in which they do it. So it does really vary, but the key is just working back from the sport. So just assess what are the demands of the sport and then how do I then weight my program accordingly to what's important for that sport.
That makes complete sense. What's been favorite moment in your career to date, whether it's a particular aspect or a team or at all?
Oh, that's a great question. So it would probably have to be my first test match ever that I was involved in with the Pakistan one at Rawalpindi, where Leach took a wicket. It was like in the dark with like four balls to go or something. And that was just like a mega intro into test cricket. It was like one, that just being an incredible test match in general, but that was being my first one to be a part of. Was really cool, especially away in Pakistan, which some of them been for 20 odd years. So that was really cool. And a bit of a surreal moment, I suppose.
Enjoy Pakistan as a country to tour?
You know what? We didn't really see it because you get on this armoured bus as soon as you get out of the airport, you go straight to the hotel. You're not allowed out of the hotel. And then you get on an armoured bus every day, you go to training. So, and all the roads are closed. So, yeah. It's not even like you can look out the window and like see what Pakistan's like, because Pakistan isn't roads closed and nobody outside, you know, on the side of the road. I remember seeing some footage of one of the media guys had taken of like out and about in Pakistan. I was like, all right, that's what it looks like, because the roads didn't look like that when we were on it. So yeah, it's hard to say. It's a shame we didn't get out. There's one unbelievable golf course in Multan, and that was the one we were allowed out there for a day.
Hopefully the tour at the end of this year will be a little bit more enlightening.
Yeah, with any luck, yeah.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for giving up your morning to come and chat.
No worries.
It's been awesome. But obviously wish you the best of luck with the summer ahead, hopefully getting a winning way. But yeah, thank you so much.
Cheers, no worries at all.
Podcast Network.